Thank you for listening to the audio podcast of the King's Crossing Church of Christ. To learn more or subscribe, please visit our website at kingscrossingcoc.com. As a congregation, we're doing a study through the Gospel of John, and we're looking at basically a chapter per week. For this week, we're looking here at John chapter 5. And the story in this chapter is where Jesus, as he often does, ends up going somewhere surprising and talking to someone surprising. If we were to try and talk about this location to which he goes, I think maybe the best possible thing we could compare this place to would be an asylum. So Jesus goes up to Jerusalem for this festival, and of all the places he could have started off going, the first place that he chooses to go is to this place of asylum. And when I think of this place, I think what we need to understand is that there are many places that you would go, like a hospital. If you go to a hospital, ideally you're expecting to get better or to heal or to deal with a doctor than to go home. But I'm talking about a location where many people were very sick without much prospect for improving. There was a lot of depression. This is the kind of place where if you've ever been to some place where there's just a lot of unhealthy people, it almost like it has a certain kind of smell to it, doesn't it? It's people who've been sick for a long time, not able to be cleaned that well, not especially cared for. But this place was called the Pool of Bethesda. So there's this body of water, and in the passages we read, there's kind of a legend around it where they thought that there's this natural spring that kind of causes the water to bubble a little bit, and they all thought that whenever the water's bubbling, you know, the first person who jumps in is able to get healed, but for so many people, they were never able to be the first one. So Jesus goes to this place. It says in John chapter 5 and verse 2, "Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. So maybe you remember last week, Adrian was talking about our missions program, and he was talking about the way we've had this fruitful partnership with Ronald Martinez and his family that's now lasted more than 30 years. And one of the things that he did was he kind of walked us through. 30 years ago, do you remember who it was that was president, and what was the cost of gas? And there's all these things he was talking about. But this man had been sick for even longer than that. 38 years, pretty much lying there by the Pool of Bethesda, just as an invalid with no prospects for his life, not much to do. Have you thought about what it would be like just to allow that amount of time to pass where basically nothing in your life was changing or getting better? 38 years, can you imagine all the things that have happened in your life since 1982? 1982, how old were you? What were the things you were doing? Were you even born yet? And everything that's happened since 1982, if you think about all the memories that you've had with your family, the vacations you've been on, the careers perhaps you've worked in that time, all that stuff that had happened, just imagine that instead, all that time you simply spent lying there on a mat, unable to do very much. It's an unfathomably difficult thing to conceptualize, isn't it? It's really hard to even put yourself in the place of this man and his situation. But it says in verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" I've always wanted to know what the Greek expression would be that means, well, duh, you know. It seems like such an obvious question, doesn't it? Do you want to be healed? I've been lying there for 38 years. Do you think I'd like to be healed? There's some ways in which I'd want to respond in that manner, but you know, it's a deceptively simple question that Jesus is asking here. Do you want to be healed? Well, sure, I want healing, but what we're going to see is that when we're willing to accept healing, when we're willing to accept this kind of divine gift, it's really not as simple as just being healed. When someone comes down to you from God and gives you this special gift, you know, there are certain ways we ought to respond to that. We'll talk more about that later. So Jesus asks, "Do you want to be healed?" And the sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, And while I am going, another steps down before me. So clearly in his mind, he doesn't know who Jesus is. He's really just thinking that pool is his only hope at having any change in his life. If maybe one of these times, in one of these decades, I could be the first one down in the magic water and maybe it would make me well. He's clearly not even got a category for what was about to happen to him. But I want you to dwell on these four words he begins with. I have no one. That's a tough prospect. Jesus asks him, is there anything you want? Do you want to be healed? I have no one. Jean Vanier tells a story about one time he went and visited an institution in Brazil, in fact. And as he went past this one area, it was a large room, and in this room were 40 young children, all who had significant disabilities. So he's here at this institution in Brazil. He goes past this room. There's 40 children in there in beds, way too many people for one space. But he said the strangest thing was that as you walked past this room of these disabled children, nobody was crying, that there wasn't a sound. And when he inquired, why is it that the kids, I mean, none of them are crying out, none of them are asking for help or for relief. He said, the thing is, children who cry believe there's the possibility that someone might answer their cry. But these children have lied there for so long with no response that they've simply given up on even asking for help. It's a terrible prospect to think about, to say, I have no one. I have no one. This man here has been lying there, and as he says, he has no one. You could even say this man is not even really living. He's just kind of killing time, isn't he? He's just there. And so Jesus changes everything. In verse 8, Jesus said to him, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. And then there's this ominous ending to that verse. Now that day was the Sabbath. That day was the Sabbath. So in general, if I were to come to you and you'd spent some time reading through John and I said to you, hey, so what is John chapter 5 about? You would probably say, well, this is the chapter that tells the story of Jesus healing the invalid man who'd been invalid for 38 years. Like, that would seem like it's the bigger part of the story, but in fact, what we have in this story is a very quick 9-verse telling of that episode followed by a 38-verse aftermath. If you read this story, you'll see that the healing is really just a small part of what's going on, and instead, we're going to spend a lot of time dealing with the aftermath and the implications of this story. Remember, when we're reading the Gospel of John, more than the other Gospels, John chooses to refer to Jesus' miracles, not as miracles, but as signs. When Jesus does something amazing, it should teach you something about him and who sent him. So this is a sign. Jesus has performed something amazing, but we're supposed to see that there are implications to this sign. And what happens in most of this chapter is that Jesus and the Jewish leaders begin having to kind of duke it out over exactly what these implications are and what they mean. Signs are supposed to point us to the main thing. So as I talk about this, if you'll just indulge me in my love of meme culture, my favorite meme from last year happens to really fit this scenario. But you have certain assumptions that people really possess about the way that things ought to be. On the one hand, for the Jews, they would simply assume it's wrong to do work on the Sabbath. Nobody questioned that. There's things in the law that on the seventh day God rested. On the Sabbath, you're not supposed to engage in work, not supposed to be worried about making money, making profits. You're supposed to rest on the Sabbath. So every good, decent human being knows you're supposed to take the Sabbath off. It's supposed to be a day off. A second assumption is that any person claiming to be God's equal is an unvirtuous person. And that's actually putting it mildly. If you're a person who's perhaps not sane, it would make sense perhaps that you might would claim something outlandish like that. But anyone who is a responsible, sane person doesn't go around claiming to be God's equal. And someone who does claim to be God's equal, we would say that is not a virtuous person. In fact, some of the Caesars would do that. The Caesars would claim they were actually God. You know, every Jew under Roman rule would say, among all the other things I don't like about Caesar, that is an absurd claim for any person to make. So again, all decent people would assume, if you're claiming that you're God's equal, you're not a good person. You're at least a liar, and perhaps you're also crazy. A third thing that everyone would simply assume about the world is that any person who could perform miraculous healings in God's name was someone who had God's approval. You would assume that also. If someone came to us and did something amazing and they're doing it all by God's power, giving God the credit and the glory, you would say, this must be a person that God loves and of whom God approves. But then Jesus steps in and blends these categories in a really uncomfortable fashion. Jesus shows up and he miraculously heals people on the Sabbath while openly claiming to be God's equal. And so he takes those three categories and he puts them together in such a way that really just walked all over their comfort zones. Because they would want to say that of these three principles, for him to do that, it means one of these things has not to be true as they saw it. So is it perhaps the case that maybe it is okay to work on the Sabbath? And they would say, well, certainly not, because Scripture says you shouldn't do that. It's not a virtuous thing to claim to be God's equal. He is doing that in this text, as we'll see. But then he's also going around performing divine healings and miracles. So how can it be that someone who's doing an unvirtuous thing of saying he's equal with God is doing this incredible miracle that God is enabling? How could God approve of someone who's doing this kind of thing and also on the Sabbath? So there's a real discrepancy here as they're trying to make sense of their world. Jesus has just pulled the rug out from under all of it. So a couple of questions of these implications we might be asking. One good question to ask is healing the bad kind of work, right? Like there's this kinds of work they're not supposed to be doing on the Sabbath, but no one's ever done this before, right? Jesus comes along, and it's not like they've got lots of other people who had been performing miracles, and they happen to say, well, because he's doing miracles on the Sabbath, it's different. Jesus is completely blowing the top off of their categories. They don't have a concept for this. So one question we have to be asking is, well, when you're healing, is healing really the same thing as other kinds of work? Is performing a life-giving miracle the same as simply putting in a few more hours at the office to make some more profit? Those are perhaps different categories. And also this second question, is it wrong to claim that you're equal to God if you actually are? And again, you don't have any other people who've ever come along and fit that category. Jesus is a unique person in that he's doing these miracles. He's claiming to be equal to God, but the case that Jesus is going to make in this passage is that for him to say these things, it's okay because he's speaking truth when he says them. So, also interesting to notice in this passage, no one is denying that a miraculous healing has occurred, right? Do you see that in this story? Jesus has performed it, his disciples have witnessed it, his opponents are opposing it, but the one thing that's not in question is whether it happened. He did it. Jesus performed the sign, he performed this miracle. And the other thing is, while they're disputing whether he's right or wrong, no one is also disputing whether he claimed equality with God. Jesus is overt and explicit about that as he's claiming his divine nature and where he came from. So the facts of what happened are not under debate. What is under debate is, what does this all mean? What is it that we're supposed to do with these things? So they have this lengthy exchange, and Jesus begins addressing some of the issues that they've raised because of this healing. It would also be important to note that this is one of those stories where, you know, someone like myself, I tend to be a conflict avoider. So even if I could perform amazing miracles, if I thought that was going to offend people, I'd be inclined myself to kind of walk it back so I don't have to argue with people. Jesus kind of doubles down here. So he does the miracle and on a day that offends them, in a way that offends them, and then he goes on to take it further. So Jesus is not going back at this point on anything that he's done. He is not allowing them some kind of a neutral, you know, non-confrontational option where we can be happy about the miracle and then kind of ignore the circumstances. Jesus is really forceful in what he's saying here. So where Jesus begins is in talking about a sort of family resemblance. So I don't know what it's like for you and your family. Sorry, I got a kick out of that one. I don't know what it's like in your family, but a lot of us might have someone in our family that we highly resemble. So if you saw me with my parents, a lot of people say I have a personality more like my father's, but I look a lot more like my mother. And I'm sure each of you with your parents or your children, you could kind of say they resemble this one or they resemble that one. One strange thing that happened to my family a number of years ago, I have an uncle. My dad has a brother, and they look really similar. And we were on vacation, and I know we were headed to another state. I can't remember if we were there or simply en route, but we stopped at some restaurant we'd never been at before and are simply having lunch or breakfast or whatever it was there as a family. And this one random lady walks over to our table and says, "Look, I'm really sorry to bother you, but I just have to ask," says to my father, "Are you related to Greg Adams?" He's like, "Well, yeah, that's my brother." She said, "Well, I just saw you," and I'm like, "That guy looks so much like Greg Adams. There's no way that the two of those people aren't related." So again, you have weird experiences sometimes where you have that family resemblance. But when Jesus talks about himself, he says that I am going to be busy, and I'm going to be busy specifically doing the kinds of things that my Father would be doing. When you look at me or you look at God, you're going to see this uncanny family resemblance, that we do the same kinds of things. He says, in fact, if you really know the Father, then I ought to make a lot of sense to you, because if you've really studied the Scriptures, he'll talk about Moses and some of the others, if you've really studied the Scriptures, then everything I'm doing totally makes sense and is very much in alignment with that. But likewise, he'll say in other places, well, if you want to know the Father, if you want to know what the Father is like, you can figure that out by getting to know me, because I'm like my Father. I do things like my Father. So he says there's this strong family resemblance. John chapter 5 and verse 19, Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will." So this is an important passage because Jesus is helping us understand to that question of when a person performs a miracle, is that like going to the office kind of work? And Jesus is saying, no, this is something entirely different. So what's interesting about that dispute is both Jesus and the Pharisees or other Jewish leaders would have likely hinged their argument around what God would do. And so the Jewish leaders would have said, don't you pay attention to the creation story when God worked for 6 days and then he rested on the seventh day? They would have rooted their practice of Sabbath in the methods of God. But Jesus is saying, well, even though God rested from his creative work on the Sabbath, God never stopped giving life to people on any day. God continues sustaining us. God continues being who he is. And in fact, they don't have a category in their mind for these healings, but he says, I'm simply doing what my Father does every day of the week. I give people life. I give people hope. And there's never a day or a time where it is inappropriate to engage in that kind of activity. Even on the seventh day, the world still turns, life still goes on, and God continues sustaining us. Giving people life is never an inappropriate thing to do. I was reading through this week, in my personal devotional lately, I've been kind of reading through the Thessalonian letters, and I came across this verse in 1 Thessalonians 3 that, to me, is just such a great encapsulation of this idea. Like, if you take the idea of giving life, there are some ways that only God can do that. But I was thinking to myself, what a great verse this is in talking about what every Christian ought to be like 7 days a week. There's never a time to take a break from doing this. So Paul says, "We sent Timothy, our brother and God's fellow worker, in the good tidings of the anointed, Jesus the Christ, to fortify you and to encourage you in your faithfulness, so no one should be wagged about by these afflictions." So you get the picture that things in life are difficult, there's oppression, there's persecution, it's not easy. And when that stuff comes, it makes us kind of falter and waver. But he's saying, I sent Timothy so for this purpose you would be fortified, you'd find yourselves stronger, you'd have ground to stand on, but also be encouraged. So I think, you know, you could very easily remove Timothy's name from that passage and try inserting your own name in that description. And I would say, what a great goal to set for yourself every day of your life. What is it that you're supposed to do when you come to church on Sunday? What is the result of you having been here today? I would think we ought to be able to say that you're our fellow worker in the good tidings of the Lord, but you are here to fortify the people around you, to give us strength, and also to encourage each other toward faithfulness. That's an appropriate goal for every Christian in every situation, because these are things that give us life, aren't they? The struggles in life that you have, the great difficulties, the illnesses, the unexpected tragedies, all the things that we encounter, these are things that are kind of soul-draining, aren't they? We have things in life that kind of drain us, but this needs to be a place where we come, where we recharge each other, where we strengthen each other, where everyone leaves feeling encouraged. We want to create a kind of positive peer pressure that I'm surrounded by people of hope. And even though in my life right now, hope might be a more difficult thing, but they're hopeful when I have a hard time being hopeful. And they make me stronger when I feel weak. How do you know when someone is of God? It's because they always go about fortifying and encouraging people toward faithfulness. And I would contend when you look at what Jesus was doing through that miracle, he was giving this guy a ground to finally stand on. He was giving him a hopeful path forward. And even though Jesus can do that in some ways that we're not capable of, perhaps, still the undergirding principle of that holds true for us, I believe. That we want to go about making people's lives better because they encountered us. And so for 38 years, this man was lying on a mat, and now suddenly he can walk. And in Jesus' comments, we see that all these ideas about him being divine, coming from above, being from the Father, there are some big implications. Remember, this is a sign. This ought to be pointing us to something. The Jewish leaders can see the implications, and they don't like them. They don't like what's implied by Jesus being able to do the things that he does. But Jesus goes ahead and articulates these things anyways. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself." So there's again that idea of giving life. "And he has given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. And those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me." That's a very explicit passage, isn't it? Maybe, like me, you've encountered people in your life who will sometimes like to make claims about how it doesn't really matter what religion you pick, because they're all kind of going towards the same thing, and as long as everyone's kind of got one that they like, we don't really need to worry about the differences. I had a lady talk to me one time, and she was talking about, like, you know, you look at the fingers of your hand, and to me it represents how, you know, you're a Christian, for example, but then there are Muslims, and there are Buddhists, and there are all these different religions in the world, but ultimately it's all leading toward, you know, the same thing in the middle of the hand. That was kind of her illustration. And on the one hand, I have to say, I find that idea highly appealing. I love the idea that maybe everybody gets to be right and we don't have to worry about sorting out differences. There's some things about that to me as a young postmodern person that I say, I really wish that were the case. But I would also have to say, in order to hold that belief, it is important that you remain as ignorant as possible about world religions, because they don't teach the same thing. They really don't. And this is one of those passages where Jesus simply doesn't allow you to fit him in this nice guy box where he's either the traveling philosopher or he's your favorite life tip guru who helps you be a little happier. Jesus is making absolute claims on your life. Because he has shown he can perform this divine healing, because he's demonstrating that he comes from God, Jesus is not asking to be your buddy. Jesus is saying that in your life, I should be the fulcrum on which everything else pivots. I'm the one unique one sent from God. All religions aren't teaching the same thing or leading to the same path, but Jesus is here making these unique and strong demands. So again, whenever someone wants to tell me that I think Jesus' teachings were good, but I like to kind of blend him with everyone else, I always say, I don't think you've actually read his teachings if you say that. Jesus makes strong and even offensive claims to people who would want to deny him. And so a strange thing happens in this story. The Jewish leaders started approaching this man who got healed, and they're grilling him on it. I mean, you'd think they could just be happy about it. He's had 38 years on the mat, and now he's up and walking. You'd think they would just be congratulating him. But instead, they're wanting to know, well, who exactly did this? Who was it that performed this healing? What was it that happened? And the guy just kind of says, almost implied, like, it's not my fault. I don't know. I don't know who the guy was. He just healed me and told me to take up my mat. You know, why are you carrying your mat? Well, he told me to. I know it's a Sabbath, but, you know, he healed me, so I'm just doing what he told me to. He didn't know anything. And so it says that Jesus goes back and finds the man that he's healed, this man who had been crippled, and he says a pretty striking thing. You remember that question that he asked him? That what seemed like a really obvious question. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed? In chapter 5 and verse 14, afterward Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. Now, Jesus does not say, and in fact, when we get to John chapter 9, Jesus is very clear that suffering in your life sometimes really is just tragic and unfortunate, and it's not the case that all suffering is a result of personal sin. Like, Jesus doesn't say that, but he does seem to be implying in this passage that perhaps what led to this man being paralyzed was a result of something sinful, because he tells him to stop it. Do you see that? He says, stop sinning so that something worse doesn't happen to you. So there's an implication that Jesus sees here in the healing that he's provided. So he's coming to this man, he sought him out, someone who hadn't even asked for it, but he's given him this opportunity to receive healing. But along with this healing, there is also this expectation that because I have done so much for you, you ought to respond in your life with gratitude. So giving healing is another way of giving life back to a person, isn't it? God's gift of life should be honored by your response of gratitude. The ways in which God has given you life, has given you opportunities, when you've prayed for healing and you have received it and things have gotten better, this really ought to be met by your response of gratitude. And the thing for each of us to dwell on is, for me, what should that look like? Because of all that God has given me, what does it look like for me to show I am truly grateful to have received what I have? In terms of the opportunities that we have, in terms of the skill sets and the gifts that you have, maybe in terms of the healing, the second chance that you've been given, what is it that you're going to do to honor Jesus and to proclaim his lordship because of what he's done? This is one of these strange stories, almost a unique story in the gospel, where this man that he healed, many of the people that he heals, like the Samaritan woman that he tells everything to, she goes off and starts proclaiming his lordship. This is the one guy, it's almost like it seems like he doesn't really care. He's glad to be healed, but as soon as he can, he tattles on Jesus to the Jewish leaders and kind of vanishes. The question is, how are we going to be better than he was in his response? So this morning, in reflecting on your life, we all have many things for which we should be grateful. But maybe there is some way in your life that you need to show God a greater gratitude. I want you to be thinking about what that is, how you can do that. Maybe this morning you're simply in that place of struggling where you are the one who is in need of healing and encouragement. And as we've talked about, it should be the role of every Christian to be a source of life-giving encouragement and solidarity with anyone who struggles from our number. But whatever your needs are this morning, if there's just something you want to talk to us about, you can, of course, always email us, call us, come by any day of the week. But this is a time we set aside as a church family. If you have a need that you'd like to bring forward to the whole church, this is a time you can do that while together we stand and sing.